Okay, this is an interview with Emeritus Professor Kelly Hardinbrooke Clifton on December 6th, 2008. And the interview is being held at 1218 University Bay Drive at Professor Kelly Hardinbrooke Clifton's home. Okay. Let's start off then with your childhood. Where were you born? And tell a little bit about your childhood, some of your early years of schooling. Start from there.
Okay. I was born the last of six children in Spokane, Washington. The oldest of my siblings was a sister who was 18 years older than I, and then my brother who was 16 years older than I, and then another sister that was 11 years older than I. Whoops. Then one that was 8 years older than I, and one that was 3 years older than I. That's not true. It's 6 years and 3 years. Anyway, I had four sisters and one brother. All of them, unfortunately, are no longer with us.
What year were you born?
1927.
And on the date?
Well, I like to say it's 72227. It's because it's July 22nd, 1927. And I went to school, the public schools in Spokane. The particular school I went to was known as one of the most diverse schools in the city, drawing from a middle-class family group to the children of people who were out of jobs, many of whom were living in shacks that they'd put together from lumber that they had stolen or found. And so it was a really mixed group. And I would say roughly 50-50 of people that were very poor. It also included the children of Japanese farmers, truck farmers.
What, truck farmers?
Yeah, truck farmers are produce farming. And My family was, I think it's fair to say that my father was well known in the city. He was on bank boards and things of that nature. He was the senior partner in a construction company that was primarily involved in highway, railroad, bridge construction, and dams. And they held jobs at any one time. They usually were holding jobs in two out of the four northwestern states, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. It was, of course, the Depression. Most of my childhood was during the Depression. My father's mother lived with us until she died when I was about six, I think. We generally, because of the Depression, we, more frequently than not, we had people, cousins or aunts or uncles, living with us. My mother had four brothers and a sister, and my father had no siblings. Mm-hmm. And he had been raised by a widowed mother. His father died when he was about five, I think. And, my mother's family were pioneers in the state of Montana. And she met Dad when she went back east to college at mm-hmm. Oberlin, Ohio. And Dad's mother had the foresight to move from an even smaller town to Oberlin with the aim of getting him into Oberlin College, mm-hmm. which she was successful at doing. That's where my parents met. And he came west then. And unlike a lot of people, they decided that when they were going to get, that they had to be out of debt when they got married.
So your parents, both of them had college degrees from Oberlin. Did the generation prior to their generation, your grandfather, did any of them have undergraduate degrees or advanced degrees?
Not to my knowledge. The earliest of the pioneers was my great grandfather's family, Hardenbrook family, and they went west in 1865. And he had gone west 2 years before that, two or three years before that, to the same area in western Montana, which at that time was having a gold rush. Mm-hmm. And he was, as far as we know, he was, by virtue of working with a physician, he was known as a physician and druggist. That was a time when they were, that was the way they operated. And most physicians were physicians by apprenticeship. And so when he went west, I don't think he ever really practiced medicine in the West, but he did distribute medications. But he also he had a an itchy foot, and he was looking for his ship to come in, and I don't think it ever really quite did. But when he went west, he took both a grand piano and in the bottom of the wagon, and his two-year-old daughter. And her formal education was by whomever was educated, I think.
Excuse me.
And she was my mother's mother. Mm-hmm. And my mother's father was the son of immigrants from Tipperary, who are buried in Madison. I didn't know this when we came here.
Oh, okay, you didn't.
Or until we came here. But I didn't know where they were buried. And I had not known that we had any relatives in Madison. That's another story. But She, my, the, her father, the mother's father, was a strong-headed man, and he became an officer in the Anaconda Copper Mining Company, which by the time I was born owned all the newspapers in the state of Montana, and pretty much people thought pretty much owned the state.
So this was John?
John R. Toole.
Toole.
Yeah. It was O'Toole, and the O was dropped went by the William O'Toole when he came. He dropped the O.
Did John R. have any advanced degrees, say, beyond high school or eighth grade that you're aware of?
We looked him up in the what records we could find of the university, mm-hmm. Which would, because they lived here, mm-hmm. In Madison.
Right.
And there were no records here of John R. Toole. It's possible that he went to one of the colleges that was more engineering-oriented, or that was engineering-oriented. I shouldn't say more, because we have a big engineering school here, and have since the Olmsted Act, I think. Anyway, we couldn't locate any indicator. We don't have no knowledge at all, as far as I know. He had as I understand it, I never met him. He died before I was born. My parents were 44, both of them. They were 6 months apart or 8 months apart in age, and my dad being a few months the older. Yeah. And I didn't know him, but he, for all intents and purposes, he was either educated beyond high school or very well self-educated. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He knew a little Latin and a little Greek, enough so that his sons used to try to trip him up on the definitions of word of English words, uh-huh. And because he of having some knowledge of Greek and Latin, he could give you a pretty good definition of most things that he hadn't known about, or words that were unfamiliar to him.
So when you think about the influences of why you went on for the degrees that you have, what comes to mind connected to your family?
Oh, the assumption that all of us would be college finished college or university, that all the whole family would. And my oldest sister and my brother both went to Oberlin for a couple of years. He loved Oberlin. She hated Oberlin. It wasn't too fast. It wasn't fast enough for her.
Uh-huh.
So she then went to USC, and he went to the University of Washington to become a civil engineer. She all but graduated. She refused to graduate because she refused to take the second semester of French, or third semester of French.
How funny.
And And that was, I'm still in awe of my father being being very cool about that problem after the amount of money that it took to send someone through USC. Mother had gone to Oberlin because her father thought Oberlin would be an appropriate school for a young lady, because it has a very good, primarily because it had a very good music program, and her sister had been admitted to Juilliard, Boston, because she was a violinist. And so anyway, mother went to Oberlin, instead of majoring in music and related lady things, she majored in chemistry and math.
Chemistry and math, which was probably very unusual for a young lady.
Yeah,
at that time
they graduated, you see, in about 1905.
Your father, what undergraduate degree did he?
Well, he took a BA, I think a very broad. I don't know what his major was, but he followed her west. They had decided that they wanted to get married, I think, when they were still in college. But they put it off. My mother used to say they put it off for 5 years from the time they met. But they were married in 1908, because by then he had paid off his college debts.
So, as the youngest of six, with an expectation that you were going to go on for a college degree, were there any other expectations placed on the direction you might go in connected to your schooling? Or was there... Let's back up a little bit more than that. What things do you think may have influenced the choices as you were growing up to direct you toward your interests that became your undergraduate degree? Let's start with those first.
Fascination with life was the thing. From the time I was little, I was fascinated by animals. My first pet was a kitten that came to the door, and we had a rule that said you cannot feed a kitten because they'll come back, and I fed the kitten, and I was.
Yeah, how old were you?
I was three or four, actually.
Wow.
The kitten turned out to be very attractive. But before that, the way the kitten got to stay after three saucers of milk over a couple of days, every year, and probably maybe twice a year, my mother had a seamstress who would come and work for a week or so with her. The two of them would work together and remodel clothing for the four daughters. And that was a rather common thing in those days. It was much less expensive and much nicer clothing, actually, that you got out of it. And I was sitting on the floor in the room where they were working together. And it was a spring day and bright sunshine, and outside of it was on the second floor of the house, but there was a trellis up the side, and the windows were open. And I was sitting on the floor, and all of a sudden, this kitten climbed in the window, jumped down to the floor, and came and sat in my lap.
Oh, wow.
And I said to Mom, can't I keep her? And she gave in. Uh-huh. And so we had, that was Funny Face.
Uh-huh.
And Funny Face became famous because she would have two litters every year.
Wow.
Spring and fall, and they were usually beautiful kittens because she bred with the three-legged tomcat that lived next door. Uh-huh. The three-legged tomcat was a Persian and a pretty nice specimen other than the big three-legged. So she had beautiful kittens. That's one nice thing about it. The other nice thing was that the kittens, she housebroke all the kittens.
Wow.
So that we never had to worry about getting rid of the kittens because we had a waiting list.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. and we had, I can remember, she always had one big orange kitten.
Uh-huh.
And on my way to school for years, I would go by, walking to my grade school, I would see this big orange cat sitting in the window, and I knew where it came from, because it was one of Funny Face's kittens.
So very early on, it sounds like, when you say a fascination for life, to be aware of this, the cat and the cycle of life and the litter.
Oh yeah, I saw kittens born when I was, I don't know, maybe six or seven.
Uh-huh.
Because I'd run downstairs when it was about time and
oh, you'd witness it
and see whether they were there. And
uh-huh.
And one time I went down and half of them were there, mm-hmm. and half of them weren't.
Uh-huh, uh-huh,
uh-huh. So, anyway, and then we spent about 4 months out of the year in the middle of the Lolo National Forest, which is just south of Glacier National Park, and
why there?
Why there? Because what happened with my grandfather, the one that was the from Madison,
mm-hmm. John R. Toole.
John R. Toole. Marcus Daly was the CEO and owner, largely, of the Anaconda Copper, ACM, or the company.
Uh-huh. Wow.
To anybody in Montana.
Uh-huh.
He was the first secretary, I think, of the ACM.
Uh-huh.
And Marcus Daly sold the company to the I'm losing names, Rockefellers.
Okay.
And so the headquarters moved east, and they offered the story is they offered John R. a very good job in the east, and he refused it.
Uh-huh.
Because he didn't want to go there and move his family and so on. And so he became secretary of a sub-company that was, I mean, he became president of a sub-company that was a lumber company that supplied the beams for the mines.
Uh-huh.
And he had been in lumber, various and sundry places. He had bought his own lumber, the trees, you know, and then sold the, on the basis of owning the trees, sold the lumber that was produced and so on. And he was doing that kind of thing in mining areas. He never picked up a shovel in his life, I don't think. He was doing that kind of thing in Challis, Idaho, and that's where my mother was born, in a little town. Still there, the last time I saw it, still had boardwalks.
Challis, Idaho.
Idaho, yeah. And it has hot springs. It's just west of, a few miles west of and a little north of Yellowstone Park.
Okay.
Anyway.
So in eastern Idaho.
Yeah. then he went to Anaconda, and he became a member of the group that established the ACM, and then he became president of the lumber company, which had one of the biggest mills in the country at the time, and that was in a town not far from Missoula. So he built a lovely southern white southern mansion in Missoula, which is now the Kappa Kappa Gamma House. And Mary Lee, one year they decided they'd be Democratic, and so they drew straws for the different rooms. She won Grandma's bedroom.
Oh, wow. So 4 months out of the year, you were out just south of Glacier National Park.
Yeah.
What was this place, and how did it have an, you know, connected to your interest in life?
Well, it was in the a forest. There were very few people. It took 3 to 5 hours to drive the 60 miles. From Missoula.
Okay.
And there were very few people. There was a regional Forest Service station. When I was came along, the roads were better. It took about 2 hours to get there. Mother's sister and her husband had bought a ranch close to the lake that actually had some of their land was on the lake. It was close to where they were lumbering.
Okay.
And close to the Blackfoot River, where they actually had did a one huge log run, and then they built a railroad to bring the logs out. But they actually had an old fashioned run.
Wow.
anyway, my grandfather thought it would the lake, Seeley Lake, would be a fine summer home. And so he built a summer home for my grandmother. And then next door, it wasn't a wedding present, because it was around 1920 that he built a place next door to it for mother and dad.
So this is where
it was a gift.
Wow.
this was in the middle of a western larch, virgin timber area with trees 150 feet high and mm-hmm. so on. And we had, because of the Aunt Thula's ranch, she ran the ranch. Her husband, Uncle George, was also in lumbering, and he wasn't around the ranch much. And they ran this as a dude ranch.
Uh-huh.
And so we had horses that, incidentally, the land that our cabins were on was national forest land, and the lease was allegedly a 99-year lease. And turns out that the government can declare 99-year leases as non-existent if they want to. And uh-huh. now I think it's the maximum you can have is 5 years or something like
wow.
that.
Uh-huh.
But so they broke all the leases. But anyway, the river that went down to the lumber mill was the Big Blackfoot River that Norman McLean made famous.
Mm-hmm.
And his cabin was about a mile away from ours. And he spent all of his life, he went every summer instead of going to Europe and so on as a good professor of romance English
uh-huh.
at the University of Chicago. He went to see the lake.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. His parents had a place there.
So here you are, surrounded by virgin yeah. woods, larch, horses.
Horses, they were cayuses. Most of them, I think, originated probably on the reservation, which was over a pass from us, about 40 miles away. And dogs.
And dogs.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was gifted great good luck to receive as a gift from the parents of a friend of mine the best dog that God ever made. And he was a mutt whose mother resembled a fox terrier, and whose father was probably she was certainly a mix, and his father was either some kind of spaniel, and I chose him out of the bunch because he had the the longest fur. One of my very good friends' families had this, the mother, and I had the first choice of the pups.
Uh-huh.
And he had a long tail and the longest ears, and they were floppy. And the longest fur.
Uh-huh.
And it was black and white.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out that he was smart. He figured things out. This is really true now.
Yeah. Oh, I'm.
because we had a big family, and because most of the time in my life that I was in Spokane, and until Mother's death, actually, we had additional relatives beyond our living with us. Mm-hmm. And this meant that there were sometimes 10 or 12 people there in the house.
Oh.
And so my mother didn't like to cook. So we had a live-in cook. I don't know why am I... Oh! And the cook at dinner time, the cook would, the routine was that she would come and grandmother picked up a bell and she'd pull the thing on the bell and go dong, dong, dong. And that was to let everybody know that dinner would be ready to go in 5 or 10 minutes, one or the other, I can't remember which. And then there would be a second dong, 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 and we would all gather for dinner, if we were already there.
Uh-huh.
And Twinks was my dog's name, Twinkles. And Mother said, you have to, he can't be in the dining room. So you got to put him out. And so I'd put Twinks out at the first bell. Well, this went on for quite a while. then one day I noticed that when the first bell rang, Twinks would disappear.
Uh-huh.
And then I discovered where he disappeared to. And he disappeared to the dining room where he lay down very quietly in a little spot close to my chair, but it was kind of in a little window area that was about like this.
So a ledge.
Yeah. And he'd come and lie. It went all the way to the floor.
Ah.
And he'd lie down in that, so he was out of the way.
Uh-huh.
of the main track. Well, it was decided that as long as he did that and didn't beg,
uh-huh,
which he never did, that it was okay.
Uh-huh.
He was rewarded because he'd figured that one out.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And it was totally, I didn't ever show him this.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I didn't come up with that at all. He figured that out. That's just one of the more outstanding kind of things that he did. And he went every, in those days, most of the time we had 4 or 5 dogs.
Uh-huh.
Because all of us were allowed to have a dog if we took care of it.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So we, at one time we had 2 little, when we got him, as a matter of fact, we had 2 French poodles for my youngest 2 of my sisters.
Uh-huh.
An Irish terrier, which was Nora's dog, given to her by her, the man who became her husband,
uh-huh,
and a white bull terrier, what we used to call, they were the what now are considered to be no-no dogs, because they're...
Like a pit bull, you
like
mean?
Like a pit bull, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Let's see. Yeah, that made, there are already 4 dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And the day that Thula, and the pit bull belonged to, or English bull terrier was what they called him at that time, belonged to my oldest sister. And she had to give it away when she got married because they couldn't keep it in the apartment that they were living in and so on. Anyway, she was getting married, and I went to visit my friend and take a look at Twinks to see how things are going, and was told by my friend's mother that they couldn't wait any longer for me to take the pup home, that I'd better take it or I'd lose it. So I took Twinks home against that. I was not to be allowed to have him until after the wedding.
Uh-huh.
Well, my bedroom was a little tiny room, much smaller than this, just enough to get a cot into and a space beside it like this, and a place for a dresser at one end. That was it. And you got to it. It was built out on a roof, added on a roof of a side porch that was to the dining room. And so I snuck him into my bedroom, and had him in a cardboard box, and my Thula was in the next room getting her wedding gown on.
Uh-huh.
She was by herself briefly, and so I brought her into my room and pulled this box out from under the bed, and there was Twinks looking up like this, and she fell in love with him right on the spot.
Uh-huh.
And she thought it was absolutely wonderful, and she said, "We'll keep a secret until this is over."
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And because I just couldn't not show him to her.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So she got married without anybody else knowing.
The Twinks was in
the bedroom.
So when you think of all these examples of you know, your awareness of animals, their intelligence, what was this, and also combined with things that may have been happening at school, and I don't know if the influence was there as well, but to talk more about what was happening for you that influence than the direction you went in.
Well, for one thing, in those days, all the dogs were free. They ran free. Twinks came to school with me every day, and he would wait. If it was good weather, he'd wait for me to finish school, and he'd walk home with me for lunch and come back. People were not very worried about other people and kids, and they were not worried about animals. He was, as a result of coming to school with me every day, and if the weather was bad, he would come to school with me, then he'd walk home, and then he'd come and meet me.
Uh-huh.
For lunch, and then he'd go home, and then he'd come and meet me.
So it was up to him.
Yeah, so it was up to him. He became very well known to the teachers. There was one art teacher that loved to sketch him.
Oh.
He was in just about all of my class pictures.
Uh-huh.
It may have helped that principal of the school was a wonderful woman that was a friend of our families. So then after I got I started carrying Saturday Evening Post and had a route that I got initially of friends of the family. Mm-hmm. But subscriptions were rare. They were, if you didn't buy the magazines in a store, they were distributed by kids. Mm-hmm. And I, there was a young man who was increasing his income by signing kids up to be carriers. Uh-huh. And what that meant was he would deliver so many posts to me and whatever I ordered mm-hmm. from him. And I'd buy them from him for a penny and a half, three and a half cents. Uh-huh. And I got a penny and a half a post. Uh-huh. And I had a humongous long, it didn't make any sense, like a newspaper carrier, but you just, you know, have one area that you deliver newspapers in. I had to walk about 2 miles or 3 miles, or four maybe. I should run over that sometime and measure how far it was that I carried the dang magazines. But anyway, I started doing that when I was seven, and the reason I wanted to do it was the horse that I had been bought for Jack, my brother, and he was not very old. he wasn't ancient when it was bought. Uh-huh. She was bought, and she was a great old horse, but she was getting on towards 30. Uh-huh. And so we were going to have to retire her. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that I wanted to make money was towards buying that horse. Uh-huh. And ultimately, in 3 years, I saved $25. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And my parents said they would match it to get me a horse. And then Nora was charged with getting the horse on the reservation, and she drove all over the reservation. And by then she had made friends with a rancher there, an elderly man, who whenever he'd see a horse, he was only interested in horses. Whenever he'd see a horse, she'd drive around looking for horses. Why, he'd yell, "Whoa!" and they'd stop and go look. Anyway, they found this little cayuse that was too small for a big man to ride. Uh-huh. And they wanted to get rid of her. The rancher wanted to get rid of her because she had a nasty habit of leading the horse herd away from, usually on these ranches, they'd turn the horses loose on their a huge pasture. Uh-huh. And all they'd have to do to get the horses to come in was to get behind them and say, "Go on, boys." Uh-huh. And they'd all go into the corral and so on. Well, the horse that became Hoopy had the habit of running the other direction and leading the herd
away.
and so they decided that they could part with her for $25. Uh-huh. So I bought my own horse.
Wow. And so that would mean, let's say, after 3 years from age seven, so you were
10 years old.
10 years old when you bought your Hoopy for $25.
For $25, okay. Yeah. Anyway, what I'm saying is that I had all these animals.
Right. Yeah. Surrounded by them.
Yeah. And that was very much to my liking.
Uh huh.
And so I was there were books that, and I'm trying to remember that Ernest Thompson Seton.
Ernest Thompson Seton.
Yeah, had written books that were very popular. He was a naturalist, and he wrote books that about animals that would be a whole life cycle.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
And Mother read to us. It was interesting. If she was reading Winnie the Pooh, the whole family would collect and and giggle around her. But one of the books, Ed Sheer read Twain and all kinds of good, interesting stuff, fascinating stuff, and part of it was books. By Ernest Thompson Seton, and that interested me very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, if I'd had my druthers, I would have been a combination of Tarzan and Dr. Doolittle.
That's what these books and these other experiences, yeah, that's what you wanted to be.
That's what I wanted to be.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to be able to talk to animals. As a kid, that was one of, it just seemed to me that would be a tremendously good thing to have. And when we... So when I went to start high school, I knew I wanted to be a biologist.
Oh, you knew then?
Yeah.
You knew then.
Yeah. And I could know that because there was one cousin, George Weisel, who became a biologist.
Uh-huh.
And so I knew, and George had lived with us for part of the time when he was going to high school. And he was came from the ranch. By then, it was a different ranch, but it was my Aunt Thula's, my mother's sister's ranch, the Circle W. He had become an ichthyologist.
Ichthyologist?
Yeah. Which is a study of, excuse me, of fish, and so I knew that it was possible that one might be able to make a living.
As a biologist.
As a biologist.
Uh-huh.
I was not at all interested in medicine.
No. Oh. Okay.
We had a 4-H club, you start out with things that aren't very expensive. The whole club does, so the first thing that we did was make insect collections. And I thought that was really neat because I had understood that in high school I would have to have an insect collection, so I could kill two birds with one stone and build up a really nice collection. Uh-huh. And we mounted them in cigar boxes, We happily sent them all to the county fair. Somebody took them all to the county fair, and the fair burned.
Oh no! Oh, your collection
and burned? All of our collections. Oh, so all of us got blue ribbons.
Oh, that's funny.
But it was okay because my high school biology, I knew more biology than the teacher.
Wow. And that was because of your childhood experiences and
I understood Punnett squares, which are the way you look at how inheritance works and so on, and I followed that. Mm-hmm. That didn't come from the 4-H, but I understood it without any problem at all, and it seemed to be confusing to a lot of the students and the teacher. But poor guy, he was not trained to, and that's unfortunately true right now. There are more teachers teaching science in the United States that have never had any science
themselves
preparation. Hmm. Themselves. Hmm. Than there are that have had science preparation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's absolutely unforgivable. Hmm. Hmm. Anyway,
so with this interest and your understandings, was there any, I mean, was this encouraged, discouraged? I mean, it sounds like it wasn't the areas that, well, your mother was a chemist, mathematician for her undergraduate degree.
Yeah, she used to say that our routine was, there were three of us still in school. Mm-hmm. Two or three. And she would say, the routine was that she'd sit at the dining room table with us sitting around the table and study.
Uh-huh.
We had things that we had to do, and uh-huh. if we had problems with things, we'd take it to mother and
mother, the chemist,
and she'd teach us algebra and so on. She handled all that with no problem, and she never objected. And one of the things that I have. That's one of the things that I feel very strongly was great with my parents was that Dad he didn't I can remember that I'd been when I got to college I came in and I was talking to him about the wonderful little flatworms that you could cut into, and mm-hmm. they'd grow a new head and a new tail, or you could split them in two, and they'd become Siamese twins.
Mm-hmm.
And this was because there was they were undifferentiated stem cells.
Really, right.
And how fascinating that was to me, and how that was controlled. And I was trying to explain to this to Dad and Mother. And after that, after I had left, the next day, Mother said, "You know, your father just is not a scientifically oriented." After you left, he said, "Nora, what was that kid talking about?" but he never did that to me.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
To my face, uh-huh. And it didn't surprise me, uh-huh. and it didn't hurt me particularly when she told me that. because he was dad, and he was wonderful on his own mm-hmm. basis, and mm-hmm. it didn't make any difference whether he understood about the flatworms
or not.
Or not.
You're comfortable for me to turn back on the?
Sure.
Okay. Okay.
So, what about science in high school? You've heard about the biology that I got, and it really was pretty uncoordinated, disorganized, and not very interesting. And the physics was somewhere near there. The chemistry was largely devoted to making things explode.
You make it sound like you were ill-prepared,
in a sense, yes. In a sense, no, because I had these very strong feelings. I don't know how many white rats that I raised until they died.
At home or at school?
I had them at home. Uh-huh. No, they didn't have things like that at school.
Did you order these wet rats?
Or? No, there were stores that the pet stores, and mice and rats were common pet store creatures.
So if I'm hearing you right, in many ways you were self-trained.
Well, I think that's being very nice to say that I was trained. There was a girl across the street from us who saw my pet rats, and so she decided she wanted to have pet rats too. And so she she got them, and they were guaranteed to be all of one sex, and it turned out that's not quite true.
Uh-oh.
And her mother, of all things, wouldn't have happened this way in our family, decided that she'd have to get rid of these baby rats, and so she took one a day from them as if they wouldn't be missed. And of course Gloria, who was about a year older than I, noted that without any problem at all, and then it became clear that she was going to have to get rid of them, the rats. So she turned them loose.
Oh no!
we had pet rats, or white rats in our neighborhood for a long time. They would come back to it and come up a trellis, and she'd put food out. They'd take the food and they'd go back. And there were Spokane's volcanic, and there were these lots that were not built on them because they were exposed volcanic rock.
So you populated your neighborhood?
So we had white rats in the neighborhood.
You probably increased the snake population too.
Maybe. Well, anyway, so I had critters around all the time. Uh-huh. And again, the rule was you take care of it, and if you don't take care of it, it goes. Uh-huh. And that seemed to me to be a very logical mm-hmm. thing. However, I and we also I, one of mother's brother is the oldest of the family. Of her family's men,
because mother she was the oldest.
Mother was the oldest in the family, but and then her sister Thula was a couple of years behind her, and then this particular uncle was Alan Toole. He was forced to a very large extent by John R. To become an engineer, because that's what real men did. And he, among one of the things that was nice that he did, was he was on the first surveying crew that surveyed Glacier Park.
Oh.
But he really wanted to be a biologist.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, he wanted to be. He had wanted to be a naturalist, and he'd wanted to teach in a good boys' high school.
Hmm.
That's what he had wanted to do.
He told you this.
Yeah, he told Mother that, and Mother told me that, and that's one of the reasons that perhaps that there would never any question that anybody would be concerned about me.
So you're allowed to follow your passion.
Yeah, and so that was a big important thing. Well, then I went into service, and this was a big thing. We had very successful recruiters for the Coast Guard, and about 10 or 15% of the graduating class of male high school students signed up for the Coast Guard.
Wow. How old were you?
17.
What year were you in high school?
I was a senior, and I quit. Because I had taken, I had wanted to go into a cadet program in the Merchant Marine cadet program, and the reason for that was that you took most of your training on the sea, and I wanted to go to sea.
Mm-hmm.
The war was D-Day had occurred.
So what year?
And that was in 1944.
Mm-hmm.
And that was before the battles of the Bulge, which were vicious, awful things. And the Japanese clearly were going to get licked. And Jack was already on Guam.
Your older brother.
My older brother, and he was he had spent about a year preparing for it in Hawaii, and getting the equipment that was needed. They built in a few short weeks. They went in on the third wave in Guam under fire and built a landing strip that carried more freight than any other landing strip in the world.
So Jack was a construction engineer?
Yeah, he was a civil engineer.
Civil.
Are the construction engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the executive officer of the 72nd Seabees Battalion. And he didn't have to go. When he, it was, well, in 1941 was the December 7th is what started the hot war with Jack was superintendent of the biggest construction job in the Spokane area, and I think in the state of Washington.
Hmm.
It was a naval supply depot, and it was built in Spokane.
Hmm.
And it was a huge job. It was so big that Dad's company had to go together with another company to take the to get the bid. He needed because it involved buildings as well as all the stuff to support the buildings. And Dad's company was the senior company, and he was the senior person, and Jack was the superintendent of that specific job. And that made him an essential person. So he was not draftable. So he quit. And joined the Seabees. And he was right commissioned.
Right after Pearl Harbor.
No, this was about the spring of 42.
But soon after.
Soon after. And now this is a side thing, but but it's something that I want to say. Nobody in our family were militaristic in any way, but one of the things that always interested me was in our library room, there was a long frame, about this long, with four pictures in it of young men in uniform for the First World War. And those were my mother's brothers. Every other male in our family that was able-bodied, and between the ages of 17 and 35 were in service. None of us. The only person that was in the that was involved in the family that was a real military person was about 5 feet six tall, called the Little Corporal, who was a third generation
pardon me.
West Point man, married one of my cousins, Johnny Johnson, and he was a wonderful man. And he was the only pro, and he wound up, his last job was the military director of Okinawa, where he was the law.
And for the occupancy,
in the occupancy, but he had been put in a training program as a trainer in the Tennessee, I think someplace, early on to train people. And they got a bunch of hillbillies, and nobody could train them. And they came to him and said, "Do you want to try it, Johnny?" He said, "Sure." And he said, "If you couldn't make a soldier out of a guy that could shoot the eye out of a squirrel at 50 yards, you're in trouble." Well, they hit it off, and when it came time for them to be assigned to go into Germany, he went with them.
Wow.
So. Well,
what was the influence of this on you?
Oh, well, when it was that it was it was an absolute requirement that I was going to go into service. I was very fortunate that I chose to do it earlier than necessary, because I had a choice that way. I didn't have to go into the army, and I didn't want to. I wanted to go into something else. I wanted, the reason I had wanted to go into the Merchant Marine Cadet Corps was that you did most of your training at sea after 6 months.
Hmm.
And then when you graduated, you got a third mate's paper for the Merchant Marine and a reserve commission in the Navy.
Uh-huh.
And I would have asked to activate my thoughts were I would activate the reserve commission and go into the regular Navy and then I got all wound up and prepared to do that.
Uh-huh.
And they closed the cadets.
Oh no.
Yeah. they got enough of them.
So. Uh-huh.
So then we were just hanging loose, and Jimmy Allen and I went into the Coast Guard when they were.
Now Jimmy Allen is your best friend at that time?
Yeah, he was a very good friend.
Good friend.
But one of the things that happened that was probably, I think, a good thing. I had scored well enough so that on the tests that they give you, that they gave me let me quit after the first 6 weeks or so of boot camp.
Uh-huh.
And go into a school, and they gave me the choice of going into radio operator school.
Uh-huh.
Do it by code.
Mm-hmm.
Radar operator school or aerographer school. Mm-hmm. Or the fourth choice was I could apply to go to the Coast Guard Academy. And I chose the radar operators because it was the shortest.
Hmm.
Well, that separated me from all the Spokane guys, and so I spent the rest of my time in service with friends that I made wherever I was that lasted about that long.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it gave me a lot of time to think about other things. And I corresponded with your mother on virtually a daily basis.
Hmm.
And as an indication of the biology thing, I was got a hold of a Reader's Digest that had an article on hybrid corn.
Uh-huh. Ah, okay.
And I got interested in that.
Uh-huh.
And I thought at the time that I wanted to go into genetics.
Uh-huh.
And so I wrote a letter to the geneticist, corn geneticist, that they had starred in the Reader's Digest thing, and asked how do I prepare educationally.
Uh-huh.
To go into genetics.
Uh-huh.
And he said he wrote back.
Wow.
And said, you want to get a good background in biological science generally.
Mm-hmm.
And then the important thing is you want to go to a good graduate school. And he said, like the University of Iowa, Iowa State, rather.
His own institution?
Right. Uh-huh. I think so. But I thought that was a very nice thing that he wrote in some detail about how you prepare yourself for it. So I was thinking about that at that time. Then when I came back and got discharged, when I was only in service actually for 15 months.
Okay.
And then the Coast Guard was in the Navy. They were part of the Navy while during wartime. But they were normally part of the Treasury Department, under the Treasury Department, and they had jumped from a service of 12,000 men to a service of 135,000 or something like that.
Wow!
And the Treasury Department, the Navy gave them back to the Treasury Department, and the Treasury Department didn't have enough money to keep them going, so they were actually just closing down big bases and discharging everybody that wasn't signed up for a permanent Coast Guard.
I would think so.
And so I got out very quickly. Well, I was later than some others because this is another story that spent my last 3 weeks in a naval hospital before I got discharged. And anyway, when I got home, by then we had decided we really liked each other. And that was one fact. The other fact was that I learned that my father was dying. Or he was going to die within months.
So you were
I got out when I was about a month and a half before my 19th birthday.
Okay.
And so there were two pieces of information. One was that I didn't particularly, and I wasn't really terribly interested in going to Oberlin anywhere else. I pretty much could have gone anywhere because the GI Bill was paid whatever it took.
Wherever you wish to go, it would cover
it. Wherever you wish to go, that you could get admission to, they'd pick up the tab. So I decided that I'd go to the University of Montana because I thought that they probably had a pretty good biology group there. And besides that, I could get home. So that's why I went to the University of Montana. I think it was one of the luckiest things I ever did in my life.
So this was a train ride away or a car drive away from home?
Yeah, exactly. And about 4 or 5 hours driving or train. The Zoo Department had some very good people, one of them being George Weisel, my cousin. I wanted to be able to go home and see your mother as well as other things, and she could come over once in a while. So, it turned out that I got more interested not in pure genetics, but in the insides of animals and what controls mechanisms there are, and and I got interested in endocrinology. And there was one of the faculty members named Ludwig Broman.
Ludwig Broman. Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
And Ludwig Broman was very much like what his name sounds like. University of Chicago PhD, and his work was in endocrinology.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And so I had the good luck. I took a job just to be around the zoo department.
Uh-huh.
I took a job and was paid 14 cents an hour, 15 cents an hour. They Montana had what they called survey courses.
Uh-huh.
And you had to take two out of the three survey courses, and one of them was bug science or general biology.
Uh-huh.
And every week they gave a multiple choice and or true false exam.
Uh-huh.
And it was a huge lecture course, and so they hired students to check the papers.
Uh-huh.
And so I checked the papers for bug science when I was a freshman. For 15 cents an hour. But this got me knowing the faculty a little better than usual. They decided that they would like to have a teaching assistant in the introductory zoology course.
Uh-huh.
With labs, so I was a lab assistant from when I started as a sophomore.
As a sophomore, you were a teaching assistant.
I was a teaching assistant as a sophomore. I wasn't in charge of the of anything.
But what did it entail?
It entailed going around and seeing that that nobody did like one girl did, who did a very carefully done big letter E. Went looking through a microscope because she got the label of the microscope in the slide in the path of the microscope, and she was told to draw what she saw.
Uh-huh.
Anyway,
that's great.
That was a neat thing, and then I took endocrinology as a independent study course with Broman.
Okay.
And he gave me he was doing actually it was just genetic study.
Uh-huh.
What he was doing was a genetic study, and he, after he had scored the rats,
mm-hmm.
then he had to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave me access to rats to learn surgery.
So you were a sophomore or a junior at this point?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the others.
Uh-huh.
So,
uh-huh.
Yeah. Then he taught me some things about rat surgery the use of ether and so on, so that I had animal handling and that I could do, and furthermore, part of his study was worked out that it selected in selecting for one particular thing that he was selecting, genetic thing that he was selecting for, also governed the nastiness of the rat. And so I was working with very nasty rats, and you learn how to handle these things pretty quick.
How to pick up, hold, be bitten, not scratched, clawed, that is.
Yeah. And so some of these rats would go,
wow.
Anyway,
you were doing surgery. You were doing autopsies of these rats.
I was doing surgery, and it was keeping the animals alive.
Well, alive. So it was true live. Okay.
Yeah, and that was kind of nice.
Yeah.
And so I was prepared by that. Well, then, and that led to graduate school because I asked Dr. Broman, about graduate school, and he said, "You don't want to go to pick a university. What you do want to do is pick a person.
Pick a person, not the campus.
Not
pick
the campus, person. The person.
Okay.
And he said, "I'll give you a list of the people that I think that are the best in the country." And he said, then he got the list and he gave it to me, and he said, what's his name? They used to call him Papa. Who came from University of Wisconsin, actually got his degree here, but he was discovered a major hormone that's interesting, and he's at Harvard. R.K. Meyer is at the University of Wisconsin. Then another guy whose names I can't remember, at Chicago. Another guy at Iowa, University of Iowa, and Cho Hao Lee at Berkeley. And he said, "Those are the five." So there are five of these.
Okay. Okay.
And he said, "And Meyer is the best because he's the youngest and most active in research. So he'd be the one that I would choose." And I said, "Well, I think I ought to apply to all of them."
Mm-hmm.
"And there are two other schools, I think, make a total of seven schools that I applied to." And I said, "If I'm not accepted at any of them, why, that's all right, because I can stay and get a master's degree here." And he looked at me and he said, "No, you can't."
And where was he coming from by saying that to you?
He was saying that you've got to leave. You got to go someplace else. And
why? Why would that be?
Why would that be?
Yeah.
Because they only offered a master's degree at Montana at that time, and he thought it would not be appropriate that I could get a master's degree with no sweat kind of, and so it would be not good for me. And he just wanted to, he wanted me to go to one of the guys that was, he thought was really the outstanding people. So I applied, I added Cornell to my list.
Yeah.
but no particular person at Cornell. And one other school, I can't remember what school that was. And they accepted me.
Did all the campuses accept you?
All five.
All five. Okay. All five.
All the five that were important that we did. And Cornell College in some little town in Iowa wrote a letter back saying, "We think you mean Cornell University."
wrote to the wrong campus.
Yeah. And so I looked at Harvard and Wisconsin on the at the top of my list, and I decided that Wisconsin was by far the best, with because of what he had said about Meyer, and the man at Harvard was getting old and was running down. I mean, his and when we went to Boston, that was clear.
Now, what was Meyer's full name again?
Roland K. Meyer.
Roland K. Meyer.
Roland Kenneth Meyer, is it?
And he was in which department specifically?
Zoology.
In zoology.
Yeah, and I took a minor in biochemistry.
In biochem.
Okay. Yeah, and I could have taken a double major, as it turns out. I didn't know that until I took my final, and was told if I had taken another course, they would have given me
a double major.
A double major.
Let's stop here.
Yeah.